89. Little Quail. Seamacher's new brown dress had been made with careful attention to her good and less good points. The bodice hugged her wasp waist, but was loosely gathered into irregular folds over her breast. To give her a fuller figure, where the bodice met the skirt, it was trimmed with two ruffles, one plain, one shiny, which bobbed up and down as she walked. Billowing sleeves concealed her thin arms. The collar, too, was a naively pretty novelty. A long strip cut separately from the same cloth, its dangling ends were tied in a bow over her breast and looked like the silvery wings of a brown butterfly. These and other special features were inspected and discussed by Seamichka's friends on the stairs outside the cloakroom when she emerged to say goodbye after the lecture. In the noisy, jostling crowd, men struggled into their military coats or civilian overcoats and lit cigarettes for the journey, while girls propped themselves up against the wall to pull on their overshoes. In their suspicious world, it might seem strange that Seamichka had chosen an evening when she was on duty to wear for the first time a dress meant for New Year's Eve. She explained to the girls that after her shift she was going on to her uncle's birthday party, where there would be other young people. Her friends admired the dress, told her that she looked really pretty, and asked where that crepe satin had been bought. But Seamichka's nerve faltered. She was in no hurry to get back. Her heart was pounding. When, at 8:02, she finally entered the acoustics laboratory, the prisoners had already handed in their secret materials to be locked in the safe. The middle of the room was bare now that the scrambler had been transferred to number 7, and she could see Nyazhin's desk. He wasn't there. Couldn't he have waited a bit? His desk lamp was out. The roll top was closed. His secret materials had been handed in. There was one unusual feature. Gleb never left things lying around during the break, but an American journal lay on top of his desk, with a dictionary, also open, beside it. Could this be a secret signal? Won't be long. Reutemann's deputy gave Seamichka the keys to the room and safe, together with the seal. Laboratories were sealed for the night. Seamichka was afraid that Reutemann might want to visit Rubin again, in which case he could look in on the acoustics laboratory at any moment. But no, Reutemann was right there, wearing cap and coat, pulling on his leather gloves, and urging his deputy to get ready quickly. He looked glum. "Right then, Serafima Vitalievna. Take over. All the best," he said, and left. The prolonged ringing of an electric bell travelled down the hallways and through the rooms of the institute. The prisoners left as one man for supper. Unsmilingly, Seamichka walked around the laboratory, watching the last of them leave. When she was not smiling, her longish nose, with its bony bridge, made her look plain and forbidding. She was alone. Now he could come. She walked round the library, wringing her hands. It would have to happen today. The silk curtains that had always hung at the windows had been taken down to be washed. The three windows were bare, unprotected, and the blackness outside would conceal anyone keeping an eye on the lab. The depths of the room were invisible from the yard. The acoustics laboratory was on the first floor. But the perimeter fence was not far away, and she and Gleb would be in full view of the sentry on the watchtower facing their window. Unless they put all the lights out when... The door would be locked, and everybody would think that she had left. But what if they tried forcing the lock, or looked for a spare key? Seamichka went over to the soundproof booth, ignoring the sentry, for whom the place was out of sight. On the threshold of this narrow little cell, she leaned against the stout double door and closed her eyes. No, she would not go in there without him. She wanted him to drag her in or carry her in bodily. She had heard from other girls how it all happens, but had only a vague picture of it. She became more and more agitated, and her cheeks burned more and more painfully. That which it had once been supremely important to preserve had now become a burden. Yes, she wanted very much to have his child and bring it up while she was waiting for him to be released. Only 5 short years. She went over to his yellow bent wood swivel chair and embraced its back as though it were a living person. She glanced at the window. The watchtower must be there, near the edge of the darkness, and on it a black concentration of all that was hostile to love, a sentry with a rifle. Gleb's footsteps in the hallway, quieter than usual. Simichka flew to her desk, sat down, drew toward her the large amplifier, which was lying on its side with its valves exposed, and began inspecting it with a small screwdriver in her hand. Her heartbeats resounded in her head. Nyerzhin pushed the door shut gently, so that the sound would not carry down the hushed hallway. Across the empty space where the scrambler had been, Gleb saw Simichka crouching behind her desk like a quail behind a tussock. Little Quail was his pet name for her. Simichka looked up at him with a bright smile, and her heart stood still. He looked worried, indeed, deeply depressed. She had been sure that he would come right over and try to kiss her, and she would have to stop him because the windows were uncurtained and the sentry could be looking. But he stayed at his own desk and spoke first. "The windows are bare, so I won't come over. Hello, Simichka." He stood bracing himself with outstretched hands against his desk and looking down at her. "If we're not interrupted, we'd better talk things over right now."
"Talk things over?"
"Talk things over." He unlocked his desk. The roll top rattled open. Without so much as a glance at Simichka, Nyerzhin assembled and opened books, journals, and folders, the camouflage she knew so well. Simichka froze, screwdriver in hand, staring fixedly at his expressionless face. Had Yakonov's summons on Saturday spelled disaster? Were they giving him a hard time? Perhaps they meant to send him away soon. But why wouldn't he come over to her? Why wouldn't he kiss her? "What's wrong? Has something happened?" she asked, with a catch in her voice and swallowing hard. He sat down. Planting his elbows on the pile of open journals, he gripped his head with the outspread fingers of both hands and looked at the girl, stared at her. But the look in his eyes was evasive. There was profound silence. Not a sound reached them. They were separated by two desks lit by four lights overhead and a lamp on each desk, and raked by the gaze of the sentry in his tower. The sentry's gaze was like a barbed wire curtain slowly lowered between them. Gleb said, "Simichka, I would consider myself a scoundrel if I didn't tell you, if I didn't confess."
"Confess?"
"I haven't been fair to you. I didn't stop to think."
"Think? Think about what?"
"The fact is, I saw my wife yesterday. We were allowed a visit." Simichka shrank. The wings of her collarband trailed limply over the aluminium panel of the apparatus. A screwdriver grated on the desk. She forced herself to speak.
"Why couldn't you, didn't you, tell me on Saturday?"
she asked brokenly.
"Simichka."
He was horrified.
"Surely you don't think I'd hide it from you?"
"Wouldn't he, though?"
"I wasn't told till yesterday morning. It took me by surprise. It's a whole year since we saw each other, as you know. Well, now we have seen each other, and—"
His voice faded. He knew what it must be like for her, listening to this, but saying it was just as— So much of what he felt was difficult to put into words, and it wouldn't help her if he could. In fact, he wasn't really sure himself what he felt. He had dreamed of this evening, this hour. On Saturday he had been in a fever of anticipation, tossing and turning in his bed. Now the hour had come, and there was nothing to prevent them. The curtains didn't matter. They had the room to themselves. What more did they need? Only yesterday he had left his soul behind. It had escaped his grasp like a fugitive kite. It was a kite flapping in the wind, and his wife was holding the string. Perhaps soul wasn't important here. Strangely, it was.
He couldn't say all this to Simochka. But what could he say? He had to say something. He fumbled for excuses.
You see, she's waited for me all the time we've been separated, my 5 years in prison and all through the war. Other women don't wait. What's more, she kept me going when I was in the camp, sent me extra food. You said you'd wait for me, but that's not... I couldn't bear to cause her.
Glib should have stopped there. His hoarse, hushed words had struck home. Little Quail was dead already, slumped over the desk, her head down among the complex array of valves and condensers that made up the three-circuit amplifier. She sobbed quietly. Her sobs were no louder than sighs.
Simochka, don't cry. You mustn't cry,
Gleb said belatedly. But still with two desks between them, keeping his distance. While she wept almost soundlessly, showing him her straight part. Seeing her helplessness, Gleb felt a pang of remorse.
Little Quail,
he mumbled, bending forward.
Please, I beg you, I'm sorry.
It hurt him to see her cry. But
the other one? It was unbearable. I don't understand myself why I feel as I do.
What would it have cost him to go over to her, take her in his arms, kiss her? But even that was impossible. He could not sully his lips and hands after his wife's visit. It was lucky that the curtains had been taken down. Instead of jumping up and hurrying from desk to desk, he stayed where he was, feebly pleading with her not to cry. She went on crying.
Little Quail, please stop. Maybe we can still, somehow, just give it a little time.
She raised her head and interrupted her weeping to look at him strangely. He could not understand her expression and lowered his eyes to the dictionary. She could hold her head up no longer, and it drooped again onto the amplifier. It would be crazy.
What did his wife's visit matter?
What good were all those women outside to him while he was there in jail? It mustn't be today, but in a few days' time his heart would be back in place and everything would be possible. And why not? If he told anybody, he'd be a laughingstock. It's time you woke up, they'd say. Time to behave like the convict you are. Who says you'll have to marry her afterward? The girl's waiting. Get on with it. Besides, only don't say it out loud, you didn't choose this particular girl. You chose this place two desks away, and you'd have gone for any girl who happened to be there. But it mustn't be today. Gleb turned away and leaned on the windowsill. With his nose and forehead pressed against the pane, he looked in the direction of the sentry. Eyes dazzled by lights nearby could not see into the watchtower. But farther away, separate lights merged and became blurred stars, while beyond and above them a third of the sky was blanched by reflected light from the capital nearby. Looking down from the window, he could see that it was thawing. Simochka raised her head. Gleb turned expectantly toward her. Wet tracks gleamed on her cheeks. She did not wipe them away. In the lamplight, her shining eyes and the feminine softening of her features made her almost attractive at that particular moment. Perhaps, even now. Simochka looked hard at Gleb, but said nothing. He felt awkward. He must say something.
And she's still, really, devoting her life to me. How many people could do that? Are you sure you could?
The tears remained undried on her numbed cheeks.
Didn't she want a divorce?
Simochka asked softly, deliberately. How quickly she had gotten to the heart of the matter. But he was reluctant to admit that something new had happened yesterday. It was much too complicated.
No.
Too pointed a question. If it were not so pointed, not so peremptory, not so sharp-edged, if we could stop calling things by their names and just look and look and look, then maybe you could get up. Maybe you could walk to the light switch. But pointed questions demand logical answers.
Is she beautiful?
Yes. To me she is, Gleb said cautiously. Simichka sighed loudly. She nodded to herself, to the broken reflection in the mirror-smooth radio valves.
She won't wait for you, then.
Simichka could not allow this invisible woman any of the advantages of a lawful wife. So she had once lived for a while with Gleb, but that was 8 years ago. Since then, Gleb had fought in the war and done time in jail, while she, if she was really beautiful and young and childless, had surely not lived like a nun. Gleb could never, not at yesterday's meeting, not in a year's time, not in 2 years, belong to her. But to Simichka he could. Simichka could become his wife that very day. That woman, no longer a phantom, no longer merely an empty name, why had she taken the trouble to get a visitor's permit? What insatiable greed made her clutch at this man who would never belong to her?
She won't wait for you,
Simichka repeated mechanically. It hurt more every time she touched that tender spot. She's waited 8 whole years already, Gleb said indignantly, but added, with his usual realism, that it would get harder before it was over.
She won't wait for you,
Simichka said yet again, in a whisper. She wiped her drying tears away with the back of her hand. Nyezhin shrugged. If he was honest, Simichka was right, of course. They would grow apart. Their characters would change. They would experience life differently. He had himself urged his wife over and over again to divorce him. But what gave Simichka the right to keep pressing on that sore spot? Anyway, suppose she doesn't wait, just as long as she has nothing to reproach me with. This seemed to be the moment for a little philosophy. Simichka, I don't consider myself a good man. In fact, I'm a very bad man. When I remember all the things I did at the front in Germany, the things we all did. And now this, with you. But believe me, I got that way in the free world, the thoughtless, comfortable, free world. I let myself be deluded into thinking that bad things are permissible. But the lower I sank, the... It's strange. She won't wait, you say? Well, she needn't wait. Just so long as I have nothing on my conscience. He had hit on a favourite theme. He could have talked about it at length, especially as there was nothing else he could say. Simichka had heard very little of this homily. He seemed unable to talk of anything but himself. But what was to become of her? She shuddered to think of herself going home, mumbling something to her tiresome mother, flopping onto her bed. The bed in which she had lain, thinking of him for months past. How shameful! How humiliating! How eagerly she had prepared for this evening! All those lotions, all that perfume! But if a one-hour prison visit with no privacy meant more to him than all the months they had spent side by side, what could she do about it? There was no need to go on. They had said all they had to say, without stopping to think or to spare each other's feelings. She ought to walk away, shut herself in the soundproof booth, weep a little longer, and pull herself together. But she could not bring herself to dismiss him or to walk away. For the last time, some tenuous thread still held them together. Gleb saw that she was not listening, that all his fine arguments were wasted on her, and said no more. He lit her cigarette, relaxed a little, and looked through the window again at the scattered yellowish lights. They sat there, saying nothing. He was beginning to feel less sorry for her. It wasn't as if her whole life depended on it. This was just a passing fancy. She would get over it, find somebody. With his wife, it was different. The silence was becoming oppressive. Gleb's only companions for many years had been other men, and he had never needed to explain himself at length. There was no more to be said. The subject was exhausted. So why were they still sitting there like dummies? Women never knew when to let go. He squinted at the electric wall clock without moving his head. He didn't want Simichka to notice. Roll call in 20 minutes. 20 minutes of the evening recreation period left. But he couldn't just get up and leave. He didn't want to hurt her feelings. He would have to sit it out. Who'll be on duty this evening? Schusterman, probably. And the junior lieutenant tomorrow morning. Simichka sat huddled over her amplifier, idly wobbling the valves out of their sockets and putting them back in again. She had never understood the first thing about that amplifier, and she understood even less now. But Nyozhin's active mind needed something to occupy it. He had made a note of the day's radio programs, as he did every morning, and slipped it under his inkstand. 20:30. RSS and RM. Abkh, he read, meaning Russian songs and romances performed by Abukhova. A rare treat, and in the quiet leisure hour. The concert had started already. But wouldn't it be a bit tactless to switch it on? A receiver permanently tuned to the three Moscow stations stood within easy reach on the windowsill, a present from Valentulia. Nyozhin glanced at the motionless Simichka and furtively switched it on at the lowest possible volume. The valves lit up, and suddenly the sound of accompanying strings, followed by Abukhova's low, hoarsely passionate, incomparable voice, broke the silence in the room. Simichka started. She looked at the receiver, then at Gleb. Abukhova was singing something painfully relevant. "No, you are not the one I burn for." The last thing they needed. Gleb fumbled for the switch and could not find it. Simichka sat slumped over her amplifier, head in hands, and wept uncontrollably. He had not been satisfied with his own hurtful words in their last few minutes together. Gleb was touched to the quick. "Forgive me," he cried. "Forgive me." He gave up feeling for the switch. Impulsively, he dashed across the room, around both desks, and with no further thought for the sentry, took her head in his hands and kissed her hair near her forehead. Simichka wept copiously, easily, no longer convulsively sobbing. These were tears of relief.